Hello and welcome back, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Space City X-Files. I'm your host, Rick. As you know, before we start this episode, I have to give you a quick content warning. Today's episode is going to be a true crime episode, and it's a particularly brutal and unsolved criminal case. It may not be suitable for all listeners. Because of all this, listener discretion is advised. Now we'll begin. In the quiet suburban streets of Setagaya, a ward nestled in the bustling city of Tokyo, the night of December 30th, 2000 began like any other. Families were settling in, the winter chill was setting in, and the world was preparing with great enthusiasm to welcome a new year. But in one household, the unimaginable was about to happen. The Miyazawa family, a seemingly ordinary family with ordinary dreams just like you and me, were unaware that this night would unfortunately be their last. By dawn, their peaceful home would turn into a crime scene, one that would baffle investigators and haunt Japan for decades. Please, buckle up, dear listeners, and prepare yourself emotionally as we begin our descent down this tragic rabbit hole. You're listening to Space City X-Files Episode 37, The Setagaya Family Murders. Before we continue with our investigation into the case of the Miyazawa family, we'd like to take a moment to express our gratitude to all our listeners. At Space City X-Files, we strive to provide the best possible experience by keeping our episodes free of commercials and ads. We rely on your support to help us grow and reach more people who share our passion for uncovering the mysteries of the unknown. If you enjoyed today's episode, we kindly request that you take a few minutes to leave us a review on the platform that you're listening on. Now, if you can't leave a written review, we realize that some platforms don't allow for that. If you can just hit a 5-star, that would be equally as great. Your feedback is invaluable in spreading awareness about the show and attracting new listeners. Additionally, if you would like to make a monetary contribution to support the program, you can visit our website, click on the Support Us tab, and there you can type in any amount you would like. Every donation we receive goes directly towards enhancing the quality of the content and helping us further our way to doing what we love to do full time. We appreciate your consideration and ongoing support. Your involvement ensures that we can continue to deliver thought-provoking episodes like today's over the Setagaya family murders and the search for justice. Thank you for being a part of Space City X-Files, and we look forward to bringing you more captivating content in the near future. This will conclude today's announcements. In the heart of Setagaya, nestled within the bustling metropolis of Tokyo, the Miyazawa family lived a life that was a tapestry of everyday joys and simple routines. Mikio, 44, and Yasuko, 41, along with their children, Nina, age 8, and Rei, age 6, were the embodiment of a contented family, much like you and me or any other family in a close-knit community. Mikio, a diligent producer, product manager, balanced his professional responsibilities with a deep commitment to his family. His wife, Yasuko, a compassionate teacher, not only educated her students, but also nurtured them with kindness and deep understanding. The children, Nina and Rei, were the epitome of youthful exuberance, filling their home with laughter and play. Their days were woven with the familiar patterns, the morning rush to school, the hectic drive to work, afternoons filled with homework and play, and evenings that brought the family together around the dinner table. Sounds wonderful. The weekends were a time for leisure, perhaps to visit the nearby park, like literally right around the corner from their house, or possibly an excursion around the vibrant city of Tokyo. In their neighborhood, the Miyazawas were known for their friendliness and engagement. All right, they were not just the residents that stuck to themselves. No, they were active participants in the community. People knew them, people loved them, and they were always contributing to local events and fostering a sense of belonging among their neighbors. All right, so they were those type of neighbors. They were the ones that were always saying hello and greeting you and going that extra mile to make you feel welcome. They're just overall good people, you know. As the year 2000 neared its end, nothing seemed amiss in the tranquil life of the Miyazawa family. The days leading up to that fateful December 30th were really unremarkable, filled with the ordinary but yet cherished moments of family life. But hidden beneath this facade of normality was a looming shadow, a tragedy that would soon unfold, leaving an enduring mark on the hearts of many in the Setagaya area. December 31st, 2000 dawned with the chilling discovery in the Setagaya district. As the first rays of the morning sun pierced the winter sky, a crime that defied comprehension came to light. It was a neighbor noting something amiss at the Miyazawa residence, who first felt the tendrils of unease. And it began with the unusual signs of life that were conspicuously absent. Concern turned to alarm quickly, leading to a call to the authorities, a call that would reveal a horrifying crime scene. The police arrived, stepping into the home that bore silent witness to an unspeakable act that had occurred the night before. The interior was disturbingly disheveled, a stark contrast to the typical orderliness of the Miyazawa household. Signs of a struggle were evident, with personal items and furniture strewn in disarray all over the place. But it was the silence, oppressive and heavy, that spoke volumes of the tragedy that unfolded. In the rooms of the house, the police discovered the bodies of the Miyazawa family. Mikio, the father, found at the bottom of the stairs, had evidently confronted the intruder, his protective instincts as a father and husband driving him to defend his family with every little bit of life he had inside of him. Yasuko and their daughter Nina were found upstairs, victims of the same brutal violence that had claimed Mikio's life. And in a heart-wrenching revelation, the youngest, Ray, was found lifeless in his bed, a tragic witness to the incomprehensible cruelty of a deranged killer. The nature of the crime was brutal and personal. The assailant had not only taken the lives of four innocent people, but he had done so with a chilling disregard for humanity. The police, seasoned in the ways of criminal investigations, were nevertheless shaken to their core by the savagery of the attack. The wounds inflicted upon the victims spoke of a deep-seated rage and a fury that defied all reason. The police began to piece together the timeline of the crime, right? It happened that the perpetrator had spent several hours within the home, both before and after the murders took place. Evidence of food consumption, the use of the family's computer, painted a picture of a killer who lingered, untroubled by the gravity of his actions. This behavior was not just confounding. It was a chilling testament to the mindset of the individual responsible. As the investigation commenced, the question on everybody's lips was why? Why the Miyazawa family? What could have possibly motivated such a heinous act? The serene neighborhood of Setagaya, once a picture of suburban tranquility, was now a backdrop for a crime that would haunt the collective consciousness of a nation. And as the hours turned into days and the days into years, the mystery of who committed this atrocious act and why only deepened. Continuing with the next segment, the investigation, we'll focus on the initial response by authorities, the evidence collected, and the challenges faced during the investigation. We'll also establish a timeline of key investigative steps. Hang on, we'll be right back. The discovery of the crime and the Miyazawa home set into motion an extensive investigation, one that would challenge the Tokyo Metropolitan Police in ways they have never experienced before. Alright, this was an unprecedented murder up until that point. The initial response was swift. Detectives and forensic teams descended upon the scene, cordoning off the area and meticulously combing through every inch of the house for clues. Alright? And that's exactly what needed to happen in this case. They had to work quickly. They couldn't let time pass, where they couldn't let the recollection of anybody who may possibly be a witness fade. They needed every little thing in order to solve this case, and the detectives involved knew this, alright? So, as the investigators delved into the details, a complex tapestry of evidence began to emerge, alright? The killer left behind a wealth of clues, fingerprints, footprints, DNA traces. Among the most perplexing pieces of evidence was a series of items that didn't belong to the family. I'm talking about a sweatshirt, a scarf, a sash, a knife, all of which were believed to belong to the assailant. And here's a crazy fact, a little crazy fact about the case. Whoever this sick son of a bitch was, he did the number two in the restroom and didn't even flush the toilet. I'm not trying to be funny or joke about it. I'm dead serious. This guy did that and left it in the toilet. And that was evidence that the police collected. And, you know, because of that, they were able to even tell what this guy was eating. You know what I mean? Up to a certain point, to the time leading up to, you know, he decided to harm this family. And we'll get more into that, but let's continue. The police also found remains of food, indicating food that belonged to the Miyazawa family, indicating that the perpetrator had taken the time to eat within the house. Took in the time to go into the raid the fridge and eat, and this added a chilling layer of even more audacity to the crime. This guy was, it's like he had no cares. In the months and years that followed, the investigation took numerous turns. In 2001, a year after the murders, the police released a composite sketches of a couple of suspects based on the evidence and potential witness accounts. All right, this was followed up by an enhanced DNA analysis in 2002. All right, so the technology was advancing as the years passed, which provided more detail about the suspect's profile. All right. The case garnered significant media attention with public appeals for information and multiple reenactments of the crime. And they were doing this in hopes to, like, jog the memory of potential witnesses, all right? Somebody who may have seen them passing on the street or leaving the area at, you know, maybe at a certain time of the night where people are not often on the streets. Anything to try to, you know, draw something from people's recollection that can possibly get peace for these people. As the investigation progressed, the police explored various theories, from a random act of violence to a targeted attack. In 2005, the police announced a pretty huge significant clue. Traces of sand were found at the crime scene, and this is crazy. This is where it starts throwing us for a little loop. The sand at this crime scene matched a specific type in the United States, hinting at a possible international connection, right? So if this, as if it wasn't crazy enough, now they're going to have to start coordinating with the U.S. This discovery led to a collaboration with international law enforcement agencies, broadening the scope of the search, of course. All right. The sand that they found was reported to be somewhere from the southwestern states, like maybe around Utah or Las Vegas. Nevada, but that's about as much as they can determine from that. All right, so this kind of led them to believe that it could have been somebody who was visiting or somebody who travels back and forth. It didn't, man, it, these are the kind of clues that really just rack your brain even more than what it already was, you know. It just added something for them to, another rabbit hole to dive down, you know, to say the least. Let's keep going. The investigation then took a technological turn in the subsequent years. Advances in forensic science, as we were saying, it was progressing, allowed for more of a sophisticated analysis of the DNA evidence. All right. So while public databases and internet resources offer new avenues for tracking potential leads, this particular DNA evidence profile allowed them to find out basically stuff about the ethnicity and a lot of other things, even the age and all that good stuff. The police also employed psychological profiling to try and piece together the mindset and the motives of the killer. Despite these efforts, the case remained shrouded in mystery. Anniversaries of the crime were marked by renewed appeals to the public, and each passing year adding to the frustration and determination of the investigators. In 2010, a decade after the murders, the police released further details about the suspect's DNA. And in 2015, they expanded their search to include new technology methods of analysis. As of today, the Setagaya family murder case remains one of Japan's most intricate and baffling mysteries. The dedication of the investigators has never waned, but the elusive nature of the killer and the passing of time have made this case a symbol of both the capabilities and limitations of modern forensic science. The question that haunts everyone involved is whether justice will ever be served for the Miyazawa family. Continuing with the next segment, we're going to be looking at the public reaction and the impact it had on the Japanese society. We'll focus on how the media covered the crime, how the public reacted to it, of course, and its broader impact on society, as we mentioned. All right, this section will highlight the societal and emotional repercussions of the case. The Setagaya family murders, with their baffling circumstances and tragic nature, captured the attention of the nation. Of course, Japanese media, known for its extensive coverage of crime, delved deeply into the story. Newspapers, television broadcasts, and later online platforms all dissected every detail of the case. The relentless media spotlight not only brought the case to the forefront of public consciousness, but it also ignited a nationwide conversation about safety and crime prevention. The public reaction was one of shock and fear. A crime so brutal and seemingly random struck at the heart of the community's sense of security. In Setagaya and beyond, people grappled with the realization that such an atrocity could happen in what was considered a safe and peaceful area. Their home, as we were saying, was basically centered in the middle of a beautiful park area, right? It's not like they were in the rough part of town or nothing like that. They were, you know, what would look like seemingly, you know, upper middle class. So, I mean, of course, everybody is going to be, you know, scared out of their wits, thinking that if this can happen to them, of course it can happen to us. The Miyazawa family, resembling any ordinary family, this is like the everyday family, your family, my friend, you know, this became a symbol of vulnerability. parents hugged their children tighter, and neighbors viewed each other with the newfound wariness. The murders instilled a pervasive sense of unease and a reminder that evil could lurk in the most ordinary settings. The reverberations of the case were felt across Japanese society. It led to discussions about the effectiveness of law enforcement and the need for advancements in forensic science. In the years following the crime, there was a noticeable increase in security measures in the residential areas, including the installation of more surveillance cameras and neighborhood watch programs. This case also influenced the media's portrayal of crime, with a greater emphasis on investigative journalism and public awareness. Schools, workplaces, and community groups initiated more discussions about safety and emergency response, fostering a culture of vigilance and preparedness. Now, I put in the show, in the links, the basically Google Maps of the area. It'll take you right up to where the street is that leads to their house. Now the house has been, it's been basically like isolated. They put up a big fence around it and kind of closed off the driveways and stuff. They want to demo the house, but the family, as of right now, is continuing to petition the government and the local authorities to leave it there. All right. I mean, there could still be things that could be found there. The house is kind of, you know, looking rough. Nobody's living there. So, I mean, I can kind of see both sides. If it could stay there, I would leave it there. But if you go to Street View, you'll see what I'm talking about. Now, this area used to be a larger subdivision. But slowly, this renovation of the area was changing the demographics. I guess larger families were maybe moving out, and maybe a couple of smaller households, single households, were moving in. And so because of this, you know, I think like apartments started popping up around the area, and then a park, like an urban park area, started basically cut its way through the neighborhood, and they were basically buying people out of their homes, like, you know, like eminent domain type stuff. And this kind of plays into a little bit in theories. I won't get into it now. We'll talk about it later. But it's this park that's, and this park and this skate park and baseball field kind of found its way into the theories portion. And so, like I said, we'll talk about that later. But let me continue with this segment. Even as the years have passed, the Setagaya family murders remain a poignant part of Japan's collective memory. The case is often cited in discussions about unsolved crimes and the challenges faced by law enforcement in an ever-evolving society. It stands as a stark reminder of the fragility of life, an enduring quest for justice and understanding in the face of inexplicable tragedy. Alright, now let's take a look at the theories surrounding the case. As with any unsolved crime, the Setagaya family murders have spawned a myriad of theories and speculations over the years. Investigators, armchair detectives, and the public alike have all pondered over the possible motives and identity of the killer, leading to a diverse range of hypotheses. One of the more, I guess you can say, prevailing theories was that this was just a random act of violence. All right. The family basically just had a tragic misfortune of encountering somebody who was deranged. This theory is supported by the seemingly unpremeditated nature of the crime and the lack of any clear motive. All right. So there was nobody that anybody could think of that wanted to hurt the family. Not off the top of their head. Another theory posits a targeted attack. Now, this here kind of moves away from the random act, and not that they have anybody particular in mind, but this one here is saying that somebody professionally did this. Whether it was possibly linked to Mikio Miyazawa's work or some unknown personal grudge, some people theorize that it could have been somebody from his job, or maybe it was somebody from his wife's school. There was even a little, and this is where the park and the areas kind of play into this. Apparently, there was this skate park that they opened up in the area. And at this skate park, there was, you know, of course, there's kids there, and maybe they weren't the most respectful of kids, or I'm not sure how this goes, or really even how substantiated this claim is. But apparently, there was a little bit of a verbal altercation between Mikio and some kids that were at the skate park. All right. They had a few words. They think they were being too loud or something like that. And it's literally like right behind his house. But this kind of fueled a theory that possibly it was somebody from this part, you know. And the evidence collected there kind of feeds into this. Well, let me finish this up. All right. I think I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but either way, in regards to these two theories, despite extensive investigation, there's just not much evidence to substantiate these two theories. All right. Now, in the realm of more speculative ideas, so we can kind of go out on a little limb here, some have suggested the involvement of a professional hitman. All right. This is what I talked about a while ago, pointing to the efficiency and brutality of the killings. Now, this, like we said, this guy, no guns were involved. I mean, he used a knife. So, I mean, this is not like the movies, all right? This is not, oh, you know, you could just take somebody's life like that. You know, it's not like that. Like they said in Training Day, it's not like stepping on ants. This is real life. If, you know, to what kind of a state of mind do you have to be in to stick a knife into somebody multiple times while you're hearing them scream, the look in their eyes, watching the life fade from them? I mean, that's not that. I find it hard to believe that is just some, you know, a-hole that came off the street who had some kind of beef with this guy. And not just stop at the father. He went upstairs, continued with the wife and the daughter, and then went to the son and took a six-year-old's life. That's not, I find it super hard to believe that this was just somebody off the street. And I don't want to get too far into my theory yet, but I just find it really hard to believe. There's even been some... Okay, so one other little thing before we go into this next theory. So one of the reasons why they thought that it could have been somebody from the skate park, well, they actually found the guy, whoever it was, actually left behind a backpack. Now, in this backpack, which is where they found the sand, in the backpack was grip tape from a skateboard. You know, like it comes in a roll. I mean, who knows? They searched the bag. They ran forensics on the bag. Couldn't get a match. I mean, who knows if it was planted there? That's the part that racks your brain. Who knows if it was planted there? Others have ventured into even wilder territory, speculating about cult involvement or maybe an international criminal element, especially considering the foreign sand found at the crime scene. These theories, while intriguing, of course, lacked concrete evidence, and are often regarded as sensationalist. To gain a deeper understanding, we turn to expert opinions. All right. Criminologist, forensic psychologist who have studied the case note the unusual behavior of the killer. All right. Spending hours at the crime scene, using the family's computer, consuming food, relieving himself in the bathroom. These actions suggest a level of comfort and confidence unusual for a typical murder. There's nothing typical about this case. Nothing at all. All right. Experts propose that this behavior could indicate. This is what the experts say. They propose that this behavior could indicate a young, possibly inexperienced offender acting on impulse rather than premeditation. And now look, I mean, I'm no professional here. I study these cases. I do listen to true crime podcasts and stuff like that. But I can only do so much of them. But you know, everything about this case to me, it just screams. It screams that this killer was experienced. He was experienced, or she was experienced. This was not the first time, in my opinion. All right, so I have to respectfully disagree with these expert opinions. Inexperienced offender acting on impulse rather than premeditation. I mean, I don't know. I just don't see it happening that way. All right, as we now dive into the world of speculation, despite the plethora of theories, experts agree on one aspect. The key to solving this case lies in the unique evidence left behind. All right, it's not through speculation. It's not through even the wilder theories. They still believe wholeheartedly that this case is going to be solved through the DNA that they have. All right, that's going to be the main thing. Unidentifiable fingerprints and DNA, the foreign sand, the killer's personal items, these hold the answers. And I agree with that much. They have to. As forensic technology advances, there remains hope. And with that hope, there's the possibility that these clues will eventually lead to the perpetrator finally providing closure to a case that has long haunted Japanese public. So as we reach the end of our journey into the heart of one of Japan's most perplexing unsolved mysteries, let's pause to reflect on what we've uncovered so far. All right, the Setagaya family murders, a case that has baffled authorities and captivated the public for years, remains shrouded in mystery. From the tragic loss of the Miyazawa family, the meticulous gathering of evidence, to the number of theories and endless speculations, this case has evolved into more than just an unsolved crime. It's become a symbol of the eternal struggle for justice and the relentless pursuit of truth. The impact of this case extends far beyond the boundaries of Setagaya or Tokyo. It touches upon our deepest fears and the challenges our understanding of safety in our communities. The story of the Miyazawa family is a stark reminder of the fragility of life and the unpredictability of human nature. It compels us to confront the uncomfortable reality that sometimes evil acts remain unexplained, and justice seems just out of reach. Yet in this darkness, there's a glimmer of hope. Advances in forensic science, the persistence of law enforcement, and the undying interest of the public keep the flame of this investigation alive. This is why we do this. This is why we cover these cases. As we look to the future, there's always the possibility that new evidence will emerge, that technology will unveil what has been hidden, and that one day, the mystery of who committed this heinous crime will be solved. To our listeners, we extend one final plea. If you have any information, no matter how small or insignificant it may seem, we urge you to come forward. Justice for the Miyazawa family is still within reach. It's still possible. There's still hope. You could help. You could be the key to unlocking this long-standing mystery. Thank you for joining us again on this exploration of the Space City X-Files. I know that this was a tough one, but we do it because every ear that listens to this case is a possible spark of a flame that bursts a new hope. That one day, this case could be brought to a close. Now, as of right now, even though it is a cold case, but our quest for answers and our hope for justice is more alive than ever. And that's why we do this. That's why we continue to bring attention to it. And we hope that others will do the same thing. You know, I hope that other people cover this case too. Because every time they do, they're bringing more attention to it. And it needs to stay in the forefront of everybody's minds. Because I'm sure it's safe to say that everyone listening, everyone taking interest in this case, is wanting and would love to see justice for the Miyazawa family, without a doubt. I know I can say that with confidence. But anyways, that's going to wrap up this week's episode. I know it was a tough one, but as always, I invite you to join us again next week for another thought-provoking episode. Next week, we're hopping back on the conspiracy train, and we're taking an in-depth exploration of the Titanic. Now, I know what you're thinking. You've already heard it before, and maybe you even saw the movie, but you haven't heard it like this, and I know you haven't. We're not looking at the things like, was the floating door big enough for both Jack and Rose? No, we're not looking at that stuff. We're looking at evidence that this whole thing, the whole doom of the Titanic, could have possibly been set up to rid the United States of men that stood in the way of serious corruption. What was that corruption? Well, you're just going to have to tune in next week to find out. That's right. You don't want to miss this one. So with that being said, join us for next week. Let your people know. There's going to be an interesting topic coming up. And until then, though, this is Rick on behalf of the Space City X-Files. Hope to see you next week. Keep questioning, keep listening, keep exploring. Love you guys.
Thank you for listening to Space City X-Files. Goodbye.